privilege.
Oh, it is my privilege to introduce tonight's 10-minute speaker. Please help me offer a welcome for Kim L. of Tulare.
I'm a hugger. Thank you, boo. Good evening. My name is Kim Lee. I am a recovered and grateful alcoholic. Gratitude. I once heard when I first met Chuck G in Hunt, Texas, that Chris Raymer would say he's never seen anyone relapse when they were in a state of gratitude. Grateful to be alive. Grateful to have sight. A few days ago, I went to the Wells Fargo Bank in Tulare, and I waited patiently in line. And I got up there, and the lady asked me, "Well, how was your day? Is everything going all right?" And I said to her, "I haven't had a bad day since I've been sober." How could I? When I've seen the horrible demoralization of my alcoholic lifestyle, of my character, I've always wondered why in the world would I would have to lose my mother when I was at age 5. For years and years, I would search and try to find out the answers from family members. They say I took it the hardest. My mother had 5 kids, and I was the 4th one born. And I was born in December 1963. From there, my alcoholic life began. I took her death the hardest, though I would not use drugs or alcohol until I reached age 19. It was there when I started to take my first drink, is where my nightmare of horrible drinking and character will catapult me into a dimension of existence that I could not believe. I've always wondered, as I said, why did my mother leave when I was such a baby? Why would she abandon us? I went to school and I seen people and children have brothers and sisters, and my brothers and sisters, we were all separated from each other. I would see kids have mommies, but go to parent conferences and would be hurt. I would take that hurt, that harm, and ruin people throughout my life of using and drinking. I remember when I was 10 years old, I was riding my bike in front of Mrs. Chris' house on R Street. I remember doing tricks on my bike to impress her of the things that I was doing in front of her yard. That was the last time that I can remember of being happy. My happiness was lost when my mother had died. And I was looking for love in all the wrong places. I searched every drug and drink possible to find the peace I had lost from losing my mother. It was there in that bottle I could escape her loss and be happy. I've been to meetings here in Visalia, in Tulare, Texas, Louisiana. I've sat right next to a gentleman who had no legs, who was blind, but yet he was in a meeting. And never blaming God for his disabilities. I've used and I've drank until oblivion. Born and raised in Tulare, I would soon, before age 23, be filled with cocaine and crack, that I would live in a box that a refrigerator would come in during a shipment. That would be my home. I went from 175 pounds to 90 pounds, drinking, using, losing, taking one step forward, two steps back. Mother Long said to me, "Kim, you ought to go into the Navy." Well, I better do that, because this what I got going out here ain't working. So I sobered up somehow, and I went into the Navy. But then I was in Pearl Harbor, living on the 78th floor in Aiea, Hawaii. I was in the Navy, working at Naval Brig Pearl Harbor. The United States Navy has a zero tolerance use. You use, you're out. No matter how good your record may be. I got this phone call from Master Chief Rodriguez. I was upstairs, I was in my apartment, and he called me. He said, "Petty Officer Lee, we need to see you here at the brig." And I knew right then, at that moment, I knew it, that I had popped positive on a urinalysis. And you would think that all the sorrow that I felt in that bitter morass, you know, and my story is in the, you all know me. You read about me in your big book every day. Because when Bill W. said no words could tell the loneliness and the despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. But I forgot. The big book also says, for reasons yet obscure, I'm sure many of you know this paragraph and this sentence, paragraph that's in the big book just as well as anyone that's ever walked this earth. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice and drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory, the suffering, and humiliation of a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. I forgot the pain and suffering of losing my mother. I forgot the humiliation that I found on that bitter day in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. For some reason, us alcoholics, we forget. I'm sure many of you have heard the story of the affluenza teen in Texas. He got off and just got probation because he was too rich to understand the consequences of his life. He crippled a young man named Sergio Molina. This young 19-year-old soccer player who had all his life ahead of him was suddenly cast to being crippled for as long as he remains alive. Ethan Couch just got probation. Then one day, he forgot. We alcoholics, for some reason, we forget the pain and the suffering. And he started drinking again, which violated his probation. And so, therefore, the federal cops were going to get him. So he leaves the state. Some of you have probably heard the story. He leaves. He forgot. He crippled. And now, this beautiful kid will never walk again. How could he forget? Well, he could forgot just as well as I forgot the pain and suffering. When I was in Austin, Texas, and I ended up here, when I was in Austin, I've done some things there that I'm not proud about. I forgot about the pain and the suffering from my Pearl Harbor experience. Although I have never been in jail, I do not know what it's like to have handcuffs on my arms. But I do know I've had handcuffs on my spirit for years. And though I've never been to jail, thank God, I am so powerless. I know if I would have went in as Kim, I would have came out of there as Kimberly. I absolutely have no control of what I may do or I may not do. Not at all. I was speaking with someone earlier today and telling them that God has done for me what I could not do for myself. I was telling him that in this life where there is trouble, that I have a God today that no matter what happens, no matter how far down the scales I may go, no matter what my past has been, I too can rise again. I was a horrible alcoholic. I know what it's like to drink and you cannot stop. I would go to meetings when I first got sober and I would hear stories and people say, well, I would dry out for a day or so. And I'm like amazed. How can someone not drink for one day? I still can't fathom that. Still cannot understand how someone can go one day without drinking. I can't do it. I've been there. I've seen the horrible. But no matter how bad my life has been because of drugs and alcohol, I'm an alcoholic. And I will forget if I'm not spiritually fit. I don't want to be like Tim Couch, who cannot take a horrible situation and begin a life and motivate himself to do the right thing. My mother passed away, and I thought I would never find joy. As I said, I was looking for love in all the wrong places. And I was thank God that I hadn't had the experience of being in jail. There was, at that time, there's God doing for me what I could not do for myself. Today, God is the paramount of my life. No matter what happens in this world, and wondering why did I have to go through so much pain and suffering, to see all my brothers and sisters die and only Kim Lee stays. Why? Why need me here? Why take Deborah Rochelle Lee, the angel of the family, and leave this crackhead, alcoholic, lying, cheater, deceiver on this earth? I think God has a plan for me. He wants me to carry the message. Even though the big book tells you, no matter how far down the scales you have gone, maybe God wants me to echo that. That you too. There's people in here that have been sober and for years and years. And I thank God for that. I thank God for the peace and serenity that I have in my life. That no matter what happens in this world, it's going to be all right. Because God is the pinnacle of my life now. He is the reason for the season. I was a person far, far away from the Lord. Today, He's the prized joy of my life. This is why I can now face things that I used to just baffle me. If you're new in recovery, I always take the big book with me when I go to meetings. If you ever see me at meetings, I always take the big book because that's where I found the solution. Not my story. We all have side stories, but the answers are right here. And I thank God for you. I thank God for Bill Hatzman for inviting me here. He is my sponsor, and he keeps me busy on my toes. But today, I don't forget. I don't forget the pain and suffering and the humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I've been reborn. My roots grasp new soil. And with that, I'll keep coming back. Thank you.
Okay, now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's main speaker. Please help me a warm Visalia or Tulare County welcome to our main speaker, Bridget B. of Los Angeles.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Bridget, and I am an alcoholic. Hello. God, welcome to our newcomers and our gentlemen with, 14 days? Welcome. Welcome to the Last Chance Saloon, because that's exactly where you are. You know, we had a gentleman from H&I up here, Monty, right? 9 years? That's right. I, too, come from a gated community, so I appreciate the H&I push. I want to thank Bill in absentia for inviting me up here. Poor Bill, he's in Australia. We feel sorry for you, Bill. Well-deserved vacation, I'm sure. Thank you, Gary, for being such a great host. And really thank you to my friend Chuck, who did an amazing workshop today. Oh, it was delightful. Thank you. It was just a great group here. And I'm Kim, what a wonderful talk. You know, the first thing that you mentioned was gratitude. And I'll tell you what, when you mentioned being grateful for your eyesight, I'm grateful every day I can move my fingers and my toes because I come from a family that what's left of them is shrapnel because of the disease of alcoholism. So, and I happen to be up here today making complete sentences. I can make change for a dollar, which is amazing. I knew how to steal them. I just didn't know how to count and make change. I'm truly blessed. Truly blessed. I do have a sobriety date. It's December 17th, 1982. I did not choose that date. I had another one. and a one before that. But I've stuck with this one, and I say that I'm sober today by the grace of a power that I'll never fully comprehend. It's not necessary because it keeps me in the game, and I keep searching every day. Every day I think I find it. As soon as I get it, goes again. And then I have to go back in the game, and it's kind of like Vishnu, that Indian god that hides, and you have to find, and then you seek, and then you find that, you know, god with skin, and that person that's just some stranger that's helping you out for no reason. And then you wake up the next day, and if you're anything like me, reentry is difficult. Mornings are tough. And that's why I hit my knees, and my first prayer is often first thought wrong. Just clear my head, first thought wrong. And then I can start my day. Because there's something about going to sleep at night with all the stuff churning in my head. Depends on what I watched on TV the night before. If I don't unplug, my brain absorbs all this. And I'll tell you, the longer I'm sober, much more sensitive I am to what goes in here, what goes in my mind, what goes in my body, what goes in my heart, what comes out of my mouth. So I say I'm sober by God's grace because I didn't pick December 17th, 1982. Who would? A week before Christmas. It makes no sense. But I didn't have a calendar and I didn't have a life, so it didn't really matter. It just so happens it was that day. That day. Well, I'll never forget where I was. I was at the lovely Pepper Tree Motel in North Hollywood. It's as glamorous as it sounds. And I had been, I just left the gated community on parole, and I couldn't stop drinking. You know, our first speaker talked about that. No amount of self-deprecation, no amount of humility, the knowledge of my condition didn't help at all. I'd been told for years that drinking and driving was a bad combination. I've been told for years that drinking, you know, when I drink, I'm open to suggestions. That's just what happens. And I do all kinds of stuff that accelerate the drinking experience. I was raised Irish Catholic, Italian Irish Catholic from the East Coast. That was a popular combination. Yeah, we were talking about that at dinner because the Irish and the Italians hated each other, but they all got married. So, and it's usually the Italian men marrying the Irish women. You know, and the Irish always bossed the Italians around. The Irish were the cops, the Italians, you were just nothing. You just get arrested. So the tables got turned. Bossy Italian dad who was very angry and very violent, and a mom who really liked the drinky poo. And I can't say that's why I'm an alcoholic, but as we heard in our workshop today, you know, I had an awful lot of justified resentments over my childhood. An awful lot. And it's funny, the longer I get sober, the better that childhood looks. It's interesting how that happens. Disease of perception. Anyways, I get out of this gated community called CIW and California Institution for Women, where, and I didn't do it, by the way, but everyone in there said I didn't do it. That's so funny. We all had that in common. I didn't do it. I'll get out of here eventually. But I'd been going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings prior to ending up in the Pepper Tree Motel. And these people from AA that actually I got introduced to through hospitals and institutions. These women came in, brought a meeting. They had directories. They had big books. They dressed well. And something was different about them because I'd heard people say, like I mentioned earlier, drinking, adding outside issues, driving, bad combination. It's bad for you. Nuns told me that. My dance coaches told me that. I wanted to be a dancer. Parents told me that. People were worried about me, but they couldn't tell me the one thing that I experienced and you experienced that they didn't experience, and that's the phenomenon of craving. You know, once I take a drink and the drink takes a drink, it's over. I lose the power of choice. I do things I would not do. I would never intentionally run someone over. I'd never kill somebody intentionally. But in a blackout, and I'm a blackout drinker, I did all kinds of stuff. And our speaker mentioned someone who did hit someone drunk and injure them. It's only seconds and inches that could have been anyone in this room that did what he did. Anyone, and maybe it was, I don't know you people. I didn't want to do those things. None of us want to. But I end up in this place called A&A. Part of my parole was to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and get court cards signed for 3 years. I thought, oh my God, I might as well stay locked up. That's what I thought about AA. I didn't understand this organization. And when I ended up at the Pepper Tree Motel, it's because I'd been bounced out of one of these places called it was a recovery house. It wasn't fancy back in 79, 80. This is almost 1981. The no frills approach to sober living. It was like 20 girls in a room, 40 in a bathroom. The food was from the Skid Row, Produce Row, they called it. We were sweeping invisible leaves. It was a nut farm. But they took us to AA meetings. That's the one thing that I did get from there, was they took us to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in these Looney Tune vans that I was embarrassed to be in. And it's funny that I'm embarrassed to be in a van. And we had to wait to get in the vans. They lined us up and we'd wait and they'd inspect the van and they'd inspect us. And I said, what am I waiting for? I'm not waiting for this nonsense. I could be inside smoking. And they said, honey, you've been standing on corners waiting for 12 years. You can wait a half an hour to get in the van. This was news to me. I didn't realize until years later when I started sponsoring people, the arrogance of the alcoholic. It'll slap you in the face once you become a sponsor. thank you again for Chuck's talk. If it weren't for that, I'll segue for a moment. I was talking to a woman on the break that I sponsor, and I have to tell you, it's like sponsoring an octopus. It's like putting socks on an octopus. That's what it's like. You say one thing, but I don't want to do. I never did that. Well, what about this? I did that all right. This doesn't work. I mean, oh my God! Seriously, I've tried everything. I wasn't like that. I didn't do that. It wasn't me. And what do? You just kind of breathe life into them and keep them entertained until God shows up or something, and you just don't drink and keep going. I mean, there's really nothing else to do. And if I forget that, if I forget the first half of the first step, I think it's my fault and she's making me look bad and I got to do something right about this. Just stop it. But I can't make her have an experience because I know how long it took me. My first experience was at the Pepper Tree Motel. These guys were picking me up, taking me to meetings, and I was drunk every single time. And this one time they came to get me and they said, we're not taking you today. You're drunk every time we come. If you want what we have, you know where to go. And they left me there. And I felt like I got kicked in the stomach because I finally identified with you people. I liked being around these guys. It was odd. I liked being around them. You know, the program of identification, like the women in CIW that told their story, they were different from a counselor or a nun or just some warden because they had what I had. They thought like I thought. They felt like I felt, and they drank like I drank. And that alcoholic thinking, till this day, it's important for me to hear that. Because the thinking, I'm not cured. I mean, this is alcoholism, not alcoholism. I have it. I'm here because I've got this thing. I've recovered physically. I've recovered a lot emotionally. Mentally, I'm a work in progress based on my spiritual condition. That's where my head's at. And if I'm not looking down and I'm not above my feet and my head somewhere else, you're in trouble. We all are. So when they left me there, I came to the next morning. It happened to be December 17th, and I had the gift of surrender. I don't know why. I knew I was going back to prison, too. I knew it, and I didn't care. I was afraid, but I said, I'm so done, and I will stay sober there, and I'll stay sober when I get out. And I got some sense of hope. I couldn't muster that on my own. I really couldn't. And I had nowhere to be that day. I didn't have to go to court for another week. And I had 2 days left on this rent in this lovely motel. So I took the bus to a meeting I'd been to a couple of times. It was in North Hollywood, the North Hollywood group. It was at this place on Radford, 4343 Radford. And I walked in there. I'd been there a couple of times before. It was on a dead-end street. It was a noon meeting. And I walked in, and it was kind of a, it's not as nice. This is a lovely facility, but there was a coffee area and a foyer I walked into, and I kind of stood there looking at the coffee and the cups, and people smoked in there. And a lot of the guys in there at this time, I was 22, and they had the wares of alcoholism on their faces, you know, the scar above the eyebrow, and the nose was over here, and you'd say, what time it is? 9 o'clock. One of those kind of guys. And I went, oh my God, this is everything I was afraid of. I'm too young for this. I can't be an alcoholic. And yet I'd, you know, just gotten out of prison, but it wasn't my fault. And I heard this woman say, get out of the half measures room and get into the meeting. And I thought, whoa, that's rude. I'm kind of new here. And I walked into the meeting, and it's funny because it reminded me, when she said that, it reminded me of my very first drink. My very first drink, I had a good 10-year run. I was 13, 14 years old, and I went to a party that I didn't want to go to. I didn't. My mom was a drinker. My brother and sister were in trouble. My dad was the violent one. I wanted to be a ballerina or a detective, okay? I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I aspired in dance. I loved dance. I got scholarships later on, and I loved Nancy Drew. Now, Nancy Drew, for some of you younger gals, she was an amateur detective. There was a series of books written about her. I guess Hardy Boys for the guys, Nancy Drew for the girls. She had a rich dad. He was an attorney. She was an only child. She had a maid. Her mother was dead. She had the perfect life. She had, you know, a credit card and a convertible. She solved crimes the FBI couldn't solve. Maybe not much of a stretch, but that's what Nancy did in her spare time. She was 18 forever. And one of my favorite Nancy Drew stories was the diamond thief. She lived in upstate New York, I think Scarsdale area, which is very wealthy. And she and her two best friends, Bess and George, they traced the diamond thieves, and she got permission from her dad to go to Russia to follow them. That's where the lead took her. And just so, and Nancy was perfect. Now, what was attractive to me is growing up as a kid. You know, I was born out of wedlock. I was heard that I wasn't wanted, and believe me, I felt it. And I thought if I were perfect, they wouldn't kill me. You know, if you're perfect, I'm the kind of alcoholic that I've got to do 200% just to be even with the rest of you. So if I'm perfect, I'll be acceptable. I can sort of slide in undetected. And Nancy was perfect. She could do everything perfectly. So she's in Russia looking for the diamond thief, and the trail leads her to the St. Petersburg where the Bolshoi Ballet is performing. And she gets there, and the ballerina, prima ballerina, the lead, is kidnapped. Nancy has her toe shoes in her purse. I don't know why, but... And she goes on and performs. She gets a standing ovation. Afterwards, she goes backstage. She finds the diamond thief, the ballerina, wrapped up. Perfect weekend. And they want to reward her, but oh no, Nancy's too humble. She goes back and says, you know, another good event done. And, you know, I wanted to be that benevolent Nancy, this superhero character. All I can say, the only thing I ended up having in common with her was larceny and that her characters were guilty of, and a big adrenaline rush, because I think I was just as addicted to that as I was alcohol. So from there, I have this drink at 15, 13. Go to a party. I don't want to be at this party. I felt like the geeky ballerina girl, and the cool girls are in the corner drinking 151 Bacardi. And I took a drink because they said, hey, you want some? And what I heard them say is, come out and hang out with us. And I had no friends. I needed to hook up. You know, we are social creatures. We can't be alone. Alcoholics especially. Step 5 in the 12 and 12 talks about this, that sense of loneliness, this feeling that we just don't quite belong. And the more we share, especially doing an inventory, the first time I did a proper fourth step, I connected with someone because my sponsor said, yeah, I so get it. I understand. And then she would elaborate a little bit. So I didn't feel so alone anymore. But, you know, that from the straight A student, ballerina / wannabe detective, that 12 years took me to places I swear I'd never go, you know. And if you're new, you may have heard about incomprehensible demoralization. I need a flea dip just thinking about those things. It was, you know, I used to go to bed at night and get on my knees and pray. I believed in this God that I was raised with, and I took a shower every night, and from there I end up in motels where the cockroaches were big enough to put a saddle on. And I remember looking at these things when I first walked in and had nowhere to live. Because my parents divorced. The one thing they didn't fight over was who was going to get Bridget. You take her, no, you take her. So I ended up in a foster home. But when I was bounced out of there, and I'm living on the land, you know, just I was free. I used to call it free. It sounded better than homeless. And Dr. Silkworth talks about this in The Doctor's Opinion, that alcoholic life seems the only normal one. After a while, that motel became home, and it was so disgusting. But you get used to it. You know, when you hit a bottom and you're drinking, whatever that is, if you decorate it, it's not a bottom anymore. It's just where you're at. It's your place. And then you hit another bottom and get some new curtains, man, because you're going to keep going down. So what got me to the gated community, and eventually to Radford, was a couple of guys. I don't have a great, exciting story. I hit bottom and kept digging, really. I wish I got married to a rich guy in a blackout, and I'm still collecting alimony, and that didn't happen. But I did meet a couple. I met a professional burglar. he just robbed a museum. And I was so impressed by that. I don't know why. He robbed a museum, and we're drinking and driving and thinking about what to do with this artwork, and we end up in the desert somewhere, and he keeps asking me if I have to use the restroom. There's no bathrooms in the desert. I may be drunk, but I'm not stupid. And I know he's going to dump me because I have evidence. I'm a witness to his crime. I've got to see the artwork. Ooh. So I know he's going to dump me, leave me for dead. So I take the next indicated action. And I had some Valium in my purse, and I poured that whole bottle into his beer. Yes, it was sufficient to have him pull over and pass out cold. And I took the next indicated action, and I kicked him out of the car, and I took off. And I kept... I just kept drinking and driving and thinking and going, what am I going to do now? If he ever wakes up, I'm dead. Where do I go? Never really thought about him again until, I don't know, a few years ago someone said, whatever happened to him? And I said, God, I never even thought about it. I'm not self-obsessed or anything. I end up back in Hollywood where I always end up. I'm like a homing pigeon. And I get the solution to my problem, which is scotch and something else. And that's where I met the car thief. Now, in between the burglar and the car thief, I had this thought that perhaps because of my tortured childhood, all I needed was the right amount of money and the right boyfriend, and perhaps I needed to pursue dancing again. Because, you see, I loved that art so much that I broke my own heart. And I blamed my parents, I blamed situations, I blamed boyfriends, I blamed anyone I could for the fact that I needed to drink. I needed to numb the pain. And so I decided, well, if I go on this dance audition and I get this job, I won't be able to drink. I'll be busy. I'll be filling up with something I love. And, of course, on the way to the audition, I have just one drink, just one, just to take the edge off so I'm not nervous. And that was at a place called the Oakwood Apartments in Hollywood. And that's the last thing I remember until I came to 2 days later. What had happened was, in that blackout, I ran a red light, and I went through an intersection, and I hit a family, and I went through the windshield of a car. And I had no idea that that had happened by the time I came out of this coma. What I thought it had happened was I'd overshot the mark again, because I had done that before. Come to and, you know, what are the cops doing here? And what do you mean it's Thursday? And what the hell's going on? Who are you? You know, one of those. But this was different. And my mother showed up, who'd heard about the accident on the news, and she took me to her house. And this is a woman I blamed for a lot of my problems. Now, the book talks about the definition between an alcoholic and a problem drinker. When you are in a blackout and you go through the windshield of a car, that's a big problem. And if you realize that and you can stop, then alcohol was the problem. But if you're anything like me and you come to and you say, I'll never take Tahunga again, that was the problem, then you might be alcoholic. Because what I needed after that was another drink. And the fact that I am not a quadriplegic from going through that windshield head on, that I didn't lose my eyes, that I didn't lose any of my limbs, that I can still talk and walk, that I didn't kill anyone in that car. That's just seconds and inches, as Norm Alpe used to say. That's some kind of grace that, it's a gift that's undeserved, and that's why I just keep paying you back. Because if I forget that, I have things that are priceless. You can't buy your limbs back. You can't. That wasn't enough for me, so, you know. Then I meet the car thief. This is the real clincher. And then I get sober, but so let me speed through the car thief thing. He steals a car, he's too drunk to drive, and dumb Bridget drives for him. And we're in the car for about 10 minutes, and we get pulled over by the police. And I wasn't aware of this at the time, but I am now, that they take Grand Theft very seriously. And they pulled me over, they had us get out face down on the ground at gunpoint, and this lovely guy, who said his name was Mark, I found out when we went to court that it wasn't Mark, but he told the cops that he was hitchhiking, he'd never seen me before. So now I'm in big trouble, which is how I end up in the gated community. Okay. From there, fast forwarding again through the Peppertree Motel, I'm standing in the Radford Clubhouse. Alabama Carruthers, my first sponsor, bless you for all the work you've done, said, get out of the half measures room and into the meeting. And I think after being appalled that she was so cold and rude, because I'm new and I have problems, because what I heard her say is, come on in and join us. And that was the first thing that attracted me to drinking, was I had a drink with those girls who I probably never saw again, could care less about me, but me and my new best friends of 10 minutes, we bonded. And when I heard someone say, come on in, I was really scared. I was so lonely, I could have just killed myself. And I needed to hook up. I needed help. And when I started to tell her my tale of woe, I need money, I don't have a place to live, my life's falling apart, I'm afraid I'm going back to jail, she goes, you know what, honey, the meeting's going to start in 10 minutes. Would you go help them set up chairs? And I said, are you kidding me? I have problems. I don't, you know, you people are like together. I thought you came that way. You know, everyone looked like Betty Crocker to me. But for some reason, I was out of ideas and I was tired, so I went and helped these people set up chairs. So when people balk at service in AA, I like to remember these little things that I do, the ripple effect of what happens. If you shine and polish something here, it will definitely sparkle over there. And I go set up these chairs, and this guy named Frank V and a woman named Connie ask me my tale of woe. I can't wait to tell them. And Frank says, "Oh, Bob's Big Boy is hiring. After the meeting, I'll take you over there because I know the manager." And I said, "Well, I've never worked, well, not for a paycheck anyway." And he said, "Oh, that's okay. Bob's prefers it that way." And then this woman, Connie, said, "I have a room for rent, $50 a week." Lo and behold, after the meeting, I go to Bob's. It's actually right across the street from the Sunset Group. It used to be this some other place. Now it was Bob's Big Boy. Now I go to meetings across the street from Bob's, where I did get fired. But I get the job. I got the job at Bob's. I moved into Connie's house, and Frank gave her $50, which I paid her back. I made that in tips in a week. My life changed on a dime because I said yes to setting up some stupid chairs. So when the IRS is after you and your husband or wife is going to leave you and the kids are drinking and you lose your job and someone says go set up chairs, I would suggest doing it. Just do it. I don't know why these actions change my life. Chapter 5 is entitled How It Works, Not Why. I don't know why. It does. These spiritual principles have been around for thousands of years, as Chuck mentioned today. It just so happens Bill and Bob seem to codify them in a way that makes sense to alcoholics, and the identification factor of us put it all together and we have a solution. Thank you, God. And I've been sober ever since. You know, I wasn't the happy-go-lucky newcomer that some of you are, or at least pretend to be, but I didn't drink. And one of the things that I really thought is that I'd had a rough life and the world should tip accordingly, and that's not what happened at Bob's, I can assure you. And somebody gave me a hard time. She flung toast at me because she said it wasn't cooked enough, and I threw it back at her. And you're not supposed to do that. So if you're new and you have an attitude problem, I wouldn't suggest waiting tables. But, you know, I'd really believe that I had something coming immediately when I got sober. And the old timers used to say to me when I was new, "You know what, kid, you got nothing coming today. If you don't drink except another day sober, that's all you get. The rest is icing on the cake." I heard it, but I didn't buy it. I didn't want that. I thought, I really deserve something else, you know. I was new. You know, you don't get here getting it. You're not supposed to get it. But, if you stay sober and you keep coming back and you get someone to take you through the book and practice these principles, eventually you will change. It's the law of gravity. What goes up must come down. And I'd had this idea that if I got fired from Bob's, it's meant to be that I drink. It's God's will. That was my idea. And my sponsor later said any alcoholic consulting with himself is getting advice from an idiot. I didn't know that at the time. I got fired. It was made sense. I flung my apron and these losers can stay at Bob's and I'm just going to hitchhike and hit the road and be free again. I'll drink. I'll show them. I don't need this life. Clearly, thank you, God, for the sign. And who's driving down Van Nuys Boulevard but this guy Frank, the guy that got me the job? And I saw him and I went, "Oh my God, they spy on us." So he pulled over, he saw me and he says, "Hey, do you want a ride?" Now I couldn't say no because when I was new I took the bus. And back then in L.A., the bus was called the RTD. And my nickname for it was Reason to Drink. I hated the bus. I hated being on the bus. I said, anybody the cops wants to find, they're on the bus. Why aren't they looking? So I got in the truck. I didn't want to look suspicious. And he says, "I just have to make one stop." And we stopped at these projects north, way up Van Nuys Boulevard, north Pacoima, really. And this woman, the reason he went there is this woman had three little kids. They all had the flu. She didn't have a car because her husband, who spent all their rent money, was drinking again, crashed the car. He's in jail. They had a three-day or quit notice. But this woman had 90 days. That's all she cared about was that 90 days. And she wanted Frank to bring her a chip. So he brings her this chip, and these kids are sick in diapers. They don't even have furniture in this place. But she said, you know, I've got something money can't buy. And she had tears in her eyes. She was so emotional about this 90 days. She said, these little kids are never going to have to see their mother sleep with the stranger again for a drink. They'll never stay at someone's house for 2 days because I'm in a blackout. If we have to sleep in the park, I will never drink again. And Frank said to her, if you stay in the middle of this herd and you stay sober, you will never have to sleep in the park. Don't worry about it. And that was my very first spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had an attitude change that was significant because of that moment. And when we left there and Frank said, where do you want to go? I couldn't imagine saying, well, I just got fired from Bob's. I need a drink after hearing this story. So we went to a meeting, and I kept going to meetings, and I kept getting busy and kept taking on commitments and, you know, got into a relationship, broke my heart. I broke hearts. It was messy. I wanted to change meetings, and then I'll go to another meeting, and no, he goes to that meeting, and she goes to that meeting, and Alabama said, pretty soon you're going to have to go to meetings in Kentucky if you don't stop this. You know, don't network in the nut house. Seriously, you've got to. I had six commitments a week. I went to meetings every day for my first 5 years. And I remember when I've got to tell the Maria story since Chuck is here. When I had 5 years of sobriety, I remember taking a cake and thinking, when you're five, you are so much less alcoholic. You know, five's the magic number. I won't be thinking about what you're thinking about me, because I know you are, but I'll think about that less. And I'll just cruise into meetings and be friendly and say hello to people. The people I hated, I won't hate anymore instantly without having to do any more inventories. And all will be well. And that's not how I felt. I took a cake for 5 years and I was disappointed. And I thought, problem right there, thinking, I thought, well, you know, I think I'm burned out on AA. I do a lot of service here. I'm very busy. I'm spinning my gears, and I'm not getting out of it what I should get. So I decided, well, I'm five. I'll go tell my mother I'm 5 years sober. She'll be proud of me. She might even write me a check. And I go to my mom's house. This is December 1987. It's the holidays, and the reason I say my mom is an alcoholic is because she admitted she was and she got sober. So I'm not breaking her anonymity, and even though she's since passed away. When I went to her house and knocked on the door of her apartment, I could tell she'd been drinking the way she said, come on in. So I walked in, and the first thing I did was I went to the refrigerator to get some iced tea, and I opened the freezer to get ice, and my cat, Maria, was in the freezer. Now, she didn't kill her, okay? My mom's not a murderer. Maria died of natural causes. I just didn't expect to find her in the freezer. So she was a very old cat, and I closed the freezer, and I thought, okay, maybe it's a turkey with a long tail, you know? If there's any Al-Anons in the room, you know, alcoholism is a disease of denial. It wasn't a turkey with a long tail. It was Maria. And my mom said, close the freezer. Maria's dead, and I haven't had time to bury her. And I said, okay, I get it. And my sister was there, my younger sister, and she said, well, it kind of makes sense, you know? I said, yeah. I said, yes. Yeah, it makes perfect sense in this family. And I walked out of there with righteous indignation because I'm sober. I'm sober. What am I around this nonsense for? Look at me, I'm sober. And I called Alabama, and now I'm really depressed, much worse than I was when I walked in. And she said, well, why did you go there? And I said, I'm five. Doesn't everybody know I'm five? No cards, no balloons, no parade. I thought she'd take me to lunch, you know, write me a check. She said, oh, so you went to get something? I said, yeah. Is that a problem? I didn't even get it. And then she said, you know, we make decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. Did you go thank your mother for visiting you in the gated community? Did you thank her for taking care of Maria? That was your cat. Did you thank her for all the prayers she said for you while you were out there, the daughter she worried about, the streets you were on? Did you thank her for that? Did you thank her for sending you to the dentist and the doctor and all those ballet lessons, things she never got? Never even occurred to me to thank her. I was there to get. Where's mine? I mean, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Ugh. Ad infinitum. And it doesn't go away completely, ever. It just comes up in a different form, my selfishness. You know, I have a master's degree now, so I can insult you with a much more sophisticated lingo. But it's still there. When I let it slip below the level of consciousness. Then she said, read the story of the jaywalker. I think it's chapter 3. The guy who skips in front of cars, he breaks a leg, this time it'll be different, he breaks his arm, he ends up in a body cast. He gets a thrill out of this stuff, but it's going to be different next time. I'll show you how. And she told me to stop going back to the scene of the crime. And I had to do another big inventory, and this time with a little bit more clarity about my family and the amends I had to make to them. That I had to change. And it didn't happen overnight, I can assure you. It's taken me a long time. It's taken years of phone calls and prayers and meetings and steps and service work and eating humble pie till I could barf to put Humpty Dumpty here back together again, I can assure you. And, you know, eventually I started changing my life and stopped blaming other people. Because blame is big for alcoholics. And I went back to school and I decided to start dancing again, and I wanted to get that college education I always thought I should have and never got. And when I was just starting school, maybe in the middle of it, my brother, who had been around the rooms for a short period of time, gorgeous guy, one of us, we're Irish twins. We were talking about that at dinner, you know, exactly a year apart. And he had just gotten out of prison and he finally got 90 days sober. And he was ecstatic. And I didn't hear from him for a while. And what happened is he drank again. And when he drank, he was with some people and he overshot the mark and went into a coma. And they couldn't revive him, so they dumped his body in a parking lot. And when he finally got to the hospital, he was in a severe, deep coma. And he stayed that way for a year. And in that year, the level of pain and anguish and anger that I felt was inexplicable. And Chuck talked about justified resentments. I found out who did it. We got a copy of the 911 tape. And all I thought about was, I'm going to go burn their house down. I'm going to do it. They've ruined our life. When my brother came out of that coma, he opened his eyes like a little chicken, you know, when they start to open their eyes, and his leg moved just a little bit like you were being hatched, and he never got past that state for 17 years. And that's a direct result of alcoholism. His sister didn't end up that way, and he did. And it's not because I'm better than my brother. He was a wonderful guy. Gorgeous, smart, ex-football player. He has the same disease as me. Why him and not me, I'll never know. But I could literally kiss the ground I walk on from here on out. Because it wasn't me. And that put my family through hell. That mother who finally got sober 9 months when this happened decided she was going to take care of him and took him in. She sold her house, rented an apartment, and her life just went to hell. And eventually she drank again. And during this period, you know, I met a woman named Kawanga B, who, God rest her soul, but I was so angry at 16, 17 years sober, I could just poke your eyes out. I was so angry. And for me, my anger is just a direct, it's a sign that Bridget's very scared. I was frightened to death. Is that going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my mother? What's going to happen to my brother? How am I going to juggle all these pieces, God? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And she took me through the Lord's Prayer for a year. I mean, we dissected that thing. And how I got there is I had to do another inventory, and I've done several, and look at what I've done in certain relationships, the way I behaved, and if I was forgiven, and I was forgiven, My father forgave me. My mother forgave me. I made amends through, you know, I tried to get credit, and I didn't know I had bad credit until I tried to get credit, and I owed some ambulance companies money. I'm like, I'm not paying these people. Why should I? Isn't that what they're there for? People like me? Well, actually, no, they're not, Bridget. They're not cruising the streets looking for drunks who've caused accidents. Started to clean up the wreckage of my own past, and I started to experience forgiveness. And when I got a grant to go back to graduate school, and this is a girl who got her GED in the gated community, and I had a heart attack. Just some rare, random aneurysm that burst in my heart. It could happen to anybody. It happened to me, and I'm cursing God again. Why me? I just lost my job. I didn't have health insurance. I got a $250,000 hospital bill from Cedars, and I almost had another heart attack. And I wondered, God, you know, what would you keep me alive for? This is way too much. My mother's taking care of my brother. I've got this bill. I'm just started graduate school. I can't pay my rent now. I can't work. And I have this Salvation Army panel, another H&I commitment, and I don't want to go. I don't feel good. I'm able to drive, but I don't feel good. It's a Saturday night. I should be looking for a guy at the Polo Lounge, not going to the Salvation Army to carry the message. I need money. Seems to always be my problem, isn't it? I needed money when I got here. I needed money at this point. It's going to solve my problem. I don't want to go. I have every excuse to cancel this panel. I may be a little crazy at times, but I've got good habits in AA. Just like brushing your teeth. If you do it every day, you just automatically do it. And my feet went to the panel. And this guy was there that had been around. He'd been sober for 8 years, and he was drinking again. And this guy looked like he just popped out of a trash can. I had barely recognized him. And he said, "You used to sponsor my sister, and I can help you with that hospital bill." And I thought, oh, you can't even afford to pay attention, but I'll listen. Then he wanted a ride home, and I just do what we do here. I've been given so many rides. I give the guy a ride home. And we exchanged numbers, and long story short, within 3 months, with his help, and this guy used to ride to my apartment on a 10-speed with a vanilla latte, spilling all the way to my apartment. There was about that much left when he got there, and he said, "Here, this is for you." And he helped me write to the right institution and the right people to get a grant that paid for that hospital bill. And all I did was go on my Salvation Army panel. And I won the lottery once again. I wouldn't suggest if you're broke going, "Hey, can I join H&I now?" You know, that you're going to get all your bills paid. That's not my point. Consistency. I am where I say I'm going to be. I said I was going to be here. Chuck said he was going to be here. And we are here. No, you're here. Someone showed up. The food was excellent. Someone showed up and cooked it. Someone showed up and set up this room, and we don't even know each other, and it just happens. You know, my life is, it's unbelievable today. I mean, 3 years ago, Chuck saw me, I was crying the blues. My brother finally passed away, and I grieved him all over again. Then my mother died of a broken heart and, a few too many pills, because she was done. She was done. And my heart was broken one more time. And the grief and the sadness and the despair, I started getting into that dark self-pity place where I thought, you know, I got something more than alcoholism. I have something wrong with me. It's really severe. I'm getting panic attacks. I'm anxious. I'm not able to, you know, I lost my job again. And looking for work when you're grieving in a wreck is not easy. And some old-timer said to me when I said, you know, I need a psychiatrist, he said, "You know what's wrong with you, don't you?" And I said, "Please tell me. I need the answer so I can go get help." He says, "What you have is advanced alcoholism. This is a progressive illness. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it gets bigger. And the gun's going to get bigger. Your spiritual life has to grow. I do more work now than I ever did when I was new because I get it. I'm more sensitive than ever. I'm just so blessed to have this life today. I'm grateful to be here. If you're new or not so new and you're having a rough time, stay on the bus because the scenery does change, and it usually changes for the better. Thanks for listening."